Chapter 4. Wounded.
Carrie woke on her 6th birthday to the sound of singing. She knew instantly that it was her birthday, her very own day. She opened her eyes to discover that balloons had been tied all around her bed, a colorful canopy. The celebration had begun. Her mom was standing by her bedside holding a coffee cake with a lit candle in it, and her dad was there too, and both of them were singing, "Happy birthday to you." Oh, unhindered joy, squeals of delight, kisses, hugs, and hoorays welcomed her into this day, just as she had been welcomed into the world 6 years earlier. Her father whispered to his little princess that he loved her. Her mother reminded her again of how happy she was to have such a wonderful daughter. There was no doubt about it. This little girl was delighted in. Life for Carrie was closer for life as God meant it to be for every little girl. She knew that her father cherished her. She was his princess. He was her knight in shining armor. He wanted to spend time with her. Carrie knew her mother loved her and wanted her. Hers was a world where her father protected her, her mother nurtured her, and she was enjoyed. This is the soil a girl's soul was meant to grow in. This was the garden her young heart was meant to flourish within. Every little girl should be so loved, so welcomed, seen, known, treasured. From this place, she can become a strong and beautiful and confident woman.
If only that was how it was for all of us.
Mothers, fathers, and their daughters.
For many centuries, women lived in close fellowship with other women, gathering at the well, down by the river, preparing meals, many occasions for femininity to just sort of naturally pass from older women to younger women. Our intuition, our keen eye for relationship, our ability to grasp matters of the heart, made any sort of formal passage into femininity unnecessary. Nowadays, those opportunities are nearly gone. When we meet as women, it tends to be in high-stress situations, corporate meetings with deadlines, ministry meetings with agendas, PTA meetings with concerns. The home is the only place left for this vital transmission of feminine identity.
The way you see yourself now, as a grown woman, was shaped early in your life, in the years when you were a little girl. You learned what it meant to be feminine, and if you were feminine, while you were very young. Women learn from their mothers what it means to be a woman, and from their fathers what value a woman has, the value that you had as a woman. If a woman is comfortable with her own femininity, her beauty, her strength, then the chances are good that her daughter will be too.
From our mothers, we receive many, many things, but foremost among them are mercy and tenderness. When my sons were young and got hurt, their dad would say something encouraging like, "Cool wound." I would hold them close and tend their injuries. Our mothers show us the merciful face of God. We are nurtured at their breasts and cradles in their arms. They rock us to sleep and sing us lullabies. Our youngest years are lived within the proximity of their apron strings, and they care for us in all the meanings of the word. When we get hurt, moms kiss us and make it better. Moms are a bit of a mystery to young girls, but also belong to a club that one day they will join. So little girls watch and learn. Little girls learn how to live as a woman by watching their mothers, their grandmothers, and taking in a myriad of lessons from all the adult women in their lives. But as for our question, that is primarily answered by our fathers.
Carrie's father was present to her. He saw her. And he made it clear that he enjoyed what he saw. He lavished affection on her with his presence, his protection, his delight. There were names he had for her, secret names only they knew. He called her Kitten and Princess and Little Darlin'. Little girls need the tender strength of their fathers. They need to know that their daddies are strong and will protect them. They need to know that their fathers are for them. And above all, a little girl learns the answer to her question from her father.
Remember twirling skirts? We twirled in front of our daddies. We wanted to know, "Daddy, am I lovely? Am I captivating? From them we learn that we are delighted in, that we are special, or that we are not. How a father relates to his daughter has an enormous effect on her soul, for good or for evil. Numerous studies have shown that women who report a close and caring relationship with their fathers, who received assurance, enjoyment, and approval from them during their childhood, suffer less from eating disorders or depression and developed a strong sense of personal identity and positive self-esteem. But Adam fell, as did Eve, and the fathers and mothers most of us had continued the sad story. They did not provide the things our hearts needed in order to become lovely, vulnerable, strong, adventurous women. No, most of our stories share a different theme.
Wounded hearts.
My friend Sandy was raised in a home with an abusive father and a weak mother. If her dad hit her mother, her mom felt she must have done something to deserve it. When the hitting turned to beating, Sandy came between her father and mother. She tried to stop her dad's cruelty and protect her mom, taking the beating herself. And when her father began to sexually abuse Sandy and her sister, her mother did nothing to protect them. She simply turned away. Sandy's dad began to bring his drunken friends home with him so that they, too, could sexually abuse his daughters. Again and again, her mother did nothing. What do you suppose Sandy learned about masculinity, about femininity, about herself?
Tracy was her parents' second daughter and did not share in the easy intimacy that she saw existed between her father and her older sister. She was uncertain about herself, about his feelings for her. On a trip to a water park, she wanted to play with her dad. She asked him to go down the slide with her in the children's area. He didn't want to. Tracy implored him to come with her. She was afraid to go alone. She wanted him to catch her at the bottom. She wanted to do it together. He acquiesced. She gleefully walked with him hand in hand to the slide, and he went down first as planned. But it was a children's slide, not made for a grown man, and when he came to the end of it, the water was too shallow for him. The force of his landing broke his foot. He was in pain, and it was her fault. That's what her young heart believed. What does that teach a girl about her desires and about the effect of her life upon others?
A woman we'll call Melissa told us, "My wound was delivered at birth. My parents had a 3-year-old little girl and desperately wanted to have a little boy. You know what's coming. They brought me to my father for the first time, and he wouldn't even hold me because he was so disappointed I was a girl. I spent my childhood trying to be a good son and prayed each night before I went to bed that I would grow a penis and turn into a boy. Each morning I would wake and check and cry because I was still a girl." How we wish we could say that stories like this are rare. The nature of the assault might be different, but the reason there are so many struggling women is because there were so many wounded girls.
Rachel had a verbally abusive father.
"I heard everything I suppose a girl can hear. You are so stupid. You are worthless. I wish we never had you. You make me sick." I grew up believing I was repulsive to my father, and I did everything I could to try and make him like me.
Abusive fathers are a too common horror. Accomplices, broken mothers are a painful reality. Both of them often come from abusive homes themselves, where the cycle of pain is ruthlessly repeated and passed down for generations. You cannot be alive very long without being wounded. The sun rises, the stars follow their courses, the waves roll in, crashing against the rocks, and we are wounded. Broken hearts cannot long be avoided in this beautiful yet dangerous world we live in. This is not Eden, not even close. We are not living in the world our souls were made for. Something's rotten in the state of Denmark and in our own backyards as we journey through the unknown terrain of the moments and months that make up our lives.
Take a deep look into the eyes of anyone, and behind the smile or the fear, you will find pain. And most people are in more pain than even they realize. Sorrow is not a stranger to any of us, though only a few have learned that it is not our enemy either. Because we are the ones loved by God, the King of Kings, Jesus Himself, who came to heal the brokenhearted and set the captives free, we can take a look back. We can take his hand and remember. We must remember if we would not be held prisoner to the wounds and the messages we received growing up. The horror that abusive fathers inflict on their daughters wounds their souls to their very core. It breaks their hearts, ushers in shame and ambivalence and a host of defensive strategies that shut down our feminine hearts. But at least the assault is obvious. The pain that absent fathers inflict on their daughters is damaging as well, but far harder to see.
Passive fathers. As I said earlier, fallen men tend to sin in one of two ways. Either they become driven, violent men, their strength gone bad, or they become passive, silent men, like Adam, their strength gone away. Lori's dad was present physically, but absent in every other way. A little girl longs to be delighted in by her father, but Lori's dad wanted nothing to do with her. When her elementary school held a father-daughter dinner, Lori desperately wanted to go. She invited her father to come. She begged him to come, but he would have none of it. Lori assumed he didn't want to attend because he was ashamed to be seen with her. As many little girls do, Lori took ballet lessons. She felt so pretty in her pink leotard and tights that she asked her father to please come and watch her dance. He answered her that when she was on a real stage, then he would come and watch her. As you might know, dance classes typically end with recitals, and so the day did come for little Lori to dance on a real stage. Pretty in her shimmering costume, she eagerly waited and watched for her father's arrival. He never came. Later that evening, friends of her father had to carry him into the house as he was too drunk to walk in by himself. Lori's little girl heart believed her dad had gone to great lengths in order not to have to watch her dance.
Debbie's father had an affair when she was young. He was not a violent man. There was nothing abusive about him. In fact, he was kind to her mother, as he was kind to Debbie and her sister. They shared Sunday dinners, went to church together, only he chose another woman. "I guess she wasn't enough to keep him," Debbie said about her mother. Then she paused and said, "I guess we weren't enough to keep him." Affairs and divorces strike at a woman's worst fear, abandonment. They wound not just the mothers, but the daughters as well. The wound is sometimes hard to identify because the transgression seemed to be against his wife. But what does the girl learn?
Jill's father divorced her mom when she was 6. In her heart, she was being divorced too.
"They tried to talk about it with us, make it all sound mature and like it's going to be okay. But he was leaving."
Her father did come for visits to take her on outings, but she learned to hide her heart from him.
"I learned to cry underwater. When we'd go to the pool, I didn't want him to see me crying."
So many girls learn something like this. Hide your vulnerability. Hide your heart. You aren't safe.
"My father was absent much of my youth. He was a man raised to be strong and good. In his era, the primary way a man showed his strength was in providing for his family. But like too many men, my dad worked long hours to provide for us financially and yet withheld the thing we needed most, himself. My father was a traveling salesman. He would be gone for 2 weeks at a time and then be home for a weekend before leaving again. An alcoholic, he often stopped off at the local bar or a neighbor's house to hoist a few before coming in our door. When he was present physically, he was absent emotionally, preferring the company of the television and a glass of scotch to his family. He didn't know me. I guess he didn't want to."
Mother wounds.
"My mom was a lonely and busy woman. When I was young, I had to pretend to be sick in order to get a morsel of her attention. I remember sitting at the kitchen table as a young girl, watching her make dinner, when she told me for the first time, but not the last, how devastated she was when she learned that she was pregnant with me. I was the last of 4 children, 2 close together, and she wept when she found out that I, the daughter of an overwhelmed mother and an absent father, was coming. You can imagine the effect that has on a little girl's heart."
Chris's dad was not absent. He was, in fact, deeply involved in her life. She loved horses, had a natural gift with them, and he was very proud of her gift. He delighted in her writing abilities and encouraged her to pursue them. He was present and supportive. He enjoyed her immensely, and she knew it. And her mother was jealous. She told Chris that her father was just using her. She spewed venom that her father was cruel and selfish, and the attention he paid her was wrong. Chris's mom belittled her love for horses, never came to a class or a show. She told Chris that in her riding clothes she looked manly and unattractive.
Dana's mother locked her and her brothers and sisters in the closet for hours on end, day after day growing up. Her mother didn't trust them, nor trust babysitters, so she would put them in the closet while she went out. They were not a poor family, but her mother bought the cheapest food possible, stale, moldy bread, overripe fruit. Her mother would feed her little, then wake her up at midnight and demand that she eat a piece of bruised, ugly fruit. She was 21 years old when she tasted her first perfectly ripe pear and wondered over the flavor. The stories of these women and the wounds they received as little girls are all different, but the effects of their wounds and the effects of ours are painfully similar. Some of these stories are extreme. The feelings of uncertainty and worthlessness that they breed are not. What was your childhood like? What lessons did you learn as a little girl? What did your parents want from you? Were you delighted in? Did you know to the core of your being that you were loved, special, worth protecting, and wanted? I pray so. But I know that for many of you, the childhood you were meant to have, the childhood you wanted to have, is a far cry from the childhood you did have. The messages of our wounds and how they shaped us. The wounds that we received as young girls did not come alone. They brought messages with them, messages that struck at the core of our hearts, right in the place of our question. Our wounds strike at the core of our femininity. The damage done to our feminine hearts through the wounds we received is made much worse by the horrible things we believe about ourselves as a result. As children, we didn't have the faculties to process and sort through what was happening to us. Our parents were godlike. We believed them to be right. If we were overwhelmed or belittled or hurt or abused, we believed that somehow it was because of us. The problem was with us.
Lori's father didn't come to her recital. He went out of his way not to come. That was the wound. The message was that she wasn't worth his time. She wasn't worth loving. She felt that there must be something terribly wrong with her. Tracy's father broke his foot. She invited him into her heart's desire, and the result was disaster. The message? Your desire for relationship causes pain. You are just too much. And she has spent the last 20 years trying not to be too much, trying to minimize her desires, trying to find some way to be loved without being too much. She has lopped off huge parts of her wonderful personality as a result.
Debbie's father had an affair. What made it confusing was that in many ways he was a good man. The message that settled in her heart as a teenage girl was, "You'd better do more than she did or you won't keep your man." After this came a young man who pursued Debbie and then left for no apparent reason. We've known this beautiful young woman for several years now, and one thing has puzzled us. Why is she always working on her life? Why is she always trying to improve herself? Debbie is always looking for something to work on. Prayer, exercise, financial responsibility, a new hair color, more discipline. Why is she trying so hard? Doesn't she know how amazing she is? What makes her search so frustrating is that she doesn't know what is wrong with her. She simply fears that somehow she is not enough. Many women feel that, by the way. We can't put words to it, but down deep we fear there is something terribly wrong with us. If we were the princess, then our prince would have come. If we were the daughter of a king, he would have fought for us. We can't help but believe that if we were different, if we were better, then we would have been loved as we so long to be. It must be us.
Sandy's father abused her, and her mother turned away. It wrought great evil upon her soul. In all that she learned, Sandy came away with two basic things about femininity. To be a woman is to be powerless. There's nothing good about vulnerability. It's just weakness. And to be feminine is to draw unwanted intimacy to yourself. Does it surprise you that she doesn't want to be feminine? Like so many sexually abused women, Sandy finds herself in the awful bind of longing for intimacy. She was created for that, but fearing to look the least bit alluring to a man. She's settled for the persona of the competent and efficient professional woman, kind but guarded, never too attractive, and never, ever in need, never weak. Some women who are sexually abused choose another path, or perhaps, more honestly, they find themselves compulsively heading in another direction. They never received love, but they did experience some sort of intimacy through the sexual abuse, and now they give themselves over to one man after another, hoping somehow to heal the wrongful sexual encounters with sex that has love to it. Melissa's mother was a wicked woman who beat her children with a wooden rod.
I was absolutely terrified of my mother. She seemed psychotic and would play evil mind games. Most of the time, we never really knew why we were getting beat. My father did nothing. One thing I did know was that with every blow, my hatred for her deepened. She turned my sister into a fragile mush of a person, and I vowed she would never do that to me. I vowed that I would be tough, hard, like a rock.
This she became, well into her adult life. See, the vows we make as children are very understandable and very, very damaging. They shut our hearts down. They are essentially a deep-seated agreement with the message of our wounds. They act as an agreement with the verdict on us. Fine. If that's how it is, then that's how it is. I'll live my life in the following way.
It's taken a lot of years for me to sort through the wounds and messages that shape my life. It's been a journey for growing clarity, understanding, and healing. Just last night, as John and I talked about this chapter, I began to realize more clearly what the message of my wounds has been. My mom was overwhelmed with the prospect of having another child, me. The message that landed in my heart was that I was overwhelming. My presence alone caused sorrow and pain. From a father who didn't seem to want to know me or be with me, I got the message, "You don't have a beauty that captivates me. You are a disappointment." When I was a little girl, I would hide in the closet. No one was looking for me. It was just that I felt safer in there. I began this hiding when I was 10 years old, the same year that my family fell apart. We had been living in Kansas in a neighborhood that was everything you would want a neighborhood to be. My sister's brother and I played with the neighborhood kids. No one had fences back then, and all was open range. And school was a place we flourished. I was voted Citizen of the Year. My oldest sister was chosen as a foreign exchange student and was supposed to go to France. My next sister was the star of the school play. My brother was popular and won awards for achievement. You get the picture. It was good. And then we moved, the result of a promotion for my dad, and it was like an atom bomb went off in our family. We had a huge support system in Kansas, much larger and stronger than we had realized. Friends, neighbors, teachers, all were holding us up. When we moved, we no longer had that support, and my family was not strong enough on its own. We fell down like a house of cards. Though my father no longer traveled as often, he worked long hours, often leaving the house before we arose and coming home long after we had fallen asleep. I would think he was away on a business trip far from home, when in reality he was just an hour's drive away. Dad was an alcoholic and was also diagnosed as bipolar. So when he was home, you never knew which father you were going to get. Would it be the happy dad or the raging father? Our home was no longer a refuge, but became a battleground. Meals together often ended with angry words and hot tears. My father's drinking increased, matched only by my mother's escalating pain and resentment. When they were together, barbs flew through the air like poisoned darts. In an effort to escape, my brother stole a car and tried to drive back to Kansas, where life was good. My mother left to stay with her parents for a while, and one of my sisters ran away. Going out to dinner with my father one night, He had too much to drink and began flirting with the waitress, asking for her phone number. It was all too much for my young, lonely heart. Back home, I went to the medicine cabinet and swallowed all the pills I thought necessary to end my life and my pain. I woke the next morning, grateful that I hadn't died, but keenly aware that my world was no longer safe. And so, I made a vow. Somewhere in my young heart, without even knowing I was doing it or putting words to it, I vowed to protect myself by never causing pain, never requiring attention. My job in the family was to be invisible, to cause no waves. If I upset things at all, surely this ship would sink. So I began to hide. I hid my needs, my desires, my very heart. I hid my true self. And when it was all too much, I hid in the closet. Fast forward 14 years. I'm now a newlywed, married to a strong and forthright husband who is not afraid of confrontation, welcomes it even. We would be sitting at the kitchen table, and if the conversation became tense, I was out of there. He would come looking for me. "Stacy, where are you?" Where was I? I was hiding in the closet. Literally. I was embarrassed by my young behavior. I felt foolish about my seeming inability to talk maturely through a disagreement. But I had never seen it done, and I didn't know how. John's slightest disappointment in something I had done triggered my unhealed heart. It took many, many months for John's love and reassurance to begin to penetrate my frightened heart. I still remember the first time we were in the middle of a disagreement and I was able to stay with him in the room. It took all of my will to keep one foot in the room while the other straddled the doorway of the bathroom, ready to retreat and to contrive safety. It was a turning point. I've never hidden in that way again. I did, however, begin to put on weight faster than you would think humanly possible. Unconsciously, I had found a new way to hide. I feared from the start of my marriage that at my core I was and would always be a disappointment to John, that it was simply a matter of time before he realized it, the message of my wound. The wounded little girl inside thought it would be better to hide, and my hiding, just like your hiding, made things much, much worse. John and I have had many years of pain. As Jesus said, "She who seeks to save her life will lose it." Matthew 16:25. The vows we make and the things we do as a result of our wounds only make matters worse.
Wounded femininity.
As a result of the wounds we receive growing up, we come to believe that some part of us, maybe every part of us, is marred. Shame enters in and makes its crippling home deep within our hearts. Shame is what makes us look away, so we avoid eye contact with strangers and friends. Shame is that feeling that haunts us, the sense that if someone really knew us, they would shake their heads in disgust and run away. Shame makes us believe that we do not measure up, not to the world's standards, the church's standards, or our own. Others seem to master their lives, but shame grips our hearts and pins them down, ever ready to point out our failures and judge our worth. We are lacking. We know we are not all that we long to be, all that God longs for us to be. But instead of coming up for grace-filled air and asking God what he thinks of us, shame keeps us pinned down and gasping, believing that we deserve to suffocate. If we were not deemed worthy of love as children, it is incredibly difficult to believe we are worth loving as adults. Shame says we are unworthy, broken, and beyond repair. Shame causes us to hide. We are afraid of being truly seen, and so we hide our truest selves and offer only what we believe is wanted. If we are a dominating kind of woman, we offer our expertise. If we are a desolate kind of woman, we offer our service. We are silent and do not say what we see or know when it is different from what others are saying because we think we must be wrong. We refuse to bring the weight of our lives, who God has made us to be, to bear on others out of a fear of being rejected. Shame makes us feel very uncomfortable with our beauty. Women are beautiful, every single one of us. It is one of the glorious ways that we bear the image of God. But few of us believe we are beautiful, and fewer still are comfortable with it. We either think we don't have any beauty, or if we do, that it's dangerous and bad. So we hide our beauty behind extra weight and layers of unnecessary makeup, or we neutralize our beauty by putting up protective, defensive walls that warn others to keep their distance.
An unholy alliance.
Over the years, we've come to see that the only thing more tragic than the things that happen to us is what we have done with them. Words were said, painful words. Things were done, awful things, and they shaped us. Something inside of us shifted. We embraced the messages of our wounds. We accepted a twisted view of ourselves. And from that, we chose a way of relating to our world. We made a vow never to be in that place again. We adopted strategies to protect ourselves from being hurt again. A woman who is living out of a broken, wounded heart is a woman who is living a self-protective life. She may not be aware of it, but it's true. It's our way of trying to save ourselves. We also developed ways of trying to get something of the love our hearts cried out for. The ache is there. Our desperate need for love and affirmation, our thirst for some taste of romance and adventure and beauty is there. So we turned to boys, or to food, or to romance novels. We lost ourselves in our work, or at church, or in some sort of service. All this adds up to the woman we are today. Much of what we call our personalities is actually the mosaic of our choices for self-protection, plus our plan to get something of the love we were created for. The problem is, our plan has nothing to do with God. The wounds we received and the messages they brought formed a sort of unholy alliance with our fallen nature as women. From Eve, we received a deep mistrust in the heart of God towards us. Clearly, He's holding out on us. We'll just have to arrange for the life we want. We will control our world. But there is also an ache deep within, an ache for intimacy and for life. We'll have to find a way to fill it, a way that does not require us to trust anyone, especially God, a way that will not require vulnerability. In some ways, this is every little girl's story here in the world east of Eden. But the wounds don't stop once we are grown up. Some of the most crippling and destructive wounds we receive come much later in our lives. The wounds that we have received over our lifetimes have not come to us in a vacuum. There is, in fact, a theme to them, a pattern. The wounds you have received have come to you for a purpose, from one who knows all you are meant to be and fears you. Chapter 5, A Special Hatred.
The storm is over now, and Stacy is weeping. She had poured so much love and care into her garden over the years, many, many hours lovingly given to creating a place of remarkable beauty. Special choices were made, seedlings transplanted with care, fertilizing, mulching, weeding. She pruned and watered and sprayed for aphids. She moved plants, replaced them, looking for just the right feel to it all. The result was stunning. People would walk up our path, stop, and just behold. It was so lovely. Wild roses, lavender, delphiniums, fountain grasses, Shasta daisies, more color and texture than I could describe. A place of rest and solace, a refuge from the world, a whiff of Eden. Until tonight. The hail began about 6 p.m. At first, it didn't seem that threatening. Summer brings a few hail showers each year in the Rockies, pea-sized balls lasting only about 10 minutes. The hail this time began the size of marbles. After 15 minutes, it began to come in the size of golf balls, pouring down like Noah's flood turned to ice. For 40 minutes it came, relentlessly, stripping branches off of trees, laying waste to all living things like some Old Testament plague. And when it finally passed on over the mountain, Stacy's garden was destroyed. I stood looking out the window in shock and grief. Summer is so short here. There are just a few months even to enjoy flowers and greenery. But this was an assault. Beauty ravaged beyond recognition. As we talked about the devastation, both of us turned in our thoughts to Eve. This ruin of a garden is a picture, a terribly fitting metaphor of what has happened to the crown of creation. How much more the grief and how much greater the loss when it is the life and heart of a woman. Yes, women have fallen from grace. Yes, they have been wounded also. But in order to understand the lingering doubts in your own heart regarding your femininity, in order to understand why it is so rare to encounter a truly alive and vibrant woman, you must hear more of the story.
Further assault. By the time I was a teenager, a girl becoming a young woman, I had pretty much divorced myself from my family. My oldest sister had moved to Europe. She went there for a 3-month vacation. She stayed 7 years. That tells you something about what life was like in our home. My brother had moved out, as had my other sister. I was left at home to finish high school. My parents began to give me some of the attention I craved as a girl, but it was too little, too late. My heart had already checked out. It was well hidden. Before them, I lived the life of smart and good student. Out of sight, I lived quite another life. I used alcohol and drugs to numb the pain of my wounds. And as so many other young women do, whose hearts have been badly missed or intentionally wounded by their fathers, I turned to boys, then to men, for love. At least, I convinced myself, I was wanted for something, if only for a night. I went to Europe my last summer of college. I was enamored by the ancient beauty I experienced, as well as by my boundless freedom. But a young, rebellious, unwise woman, set loose with a Ural pass and a bleeding heart, attracted cruel attention. While I was in Italy, I was sexually assaulted. And although I was furious at the man, deep in my heart I felt somehow worthy of assault, that I had brought it on myself. I agreed with the enemy of my soul that I was a horrid person, deserving only pain. Later, in the south of France, I unwittingly put myself in a dangerous position. After enjoying too many drinks at a local bar, my girlfriend and I accepted a ride back to the hotel from the men we had been drinking with. Oh, you must be shaking your head as you hear this, knowing what was coming. I am. Their offered ride did not lead us back to the hotel, but instead to a private location where I was raped. After the assault, I went into a state of shock. I remember discovering new bruises and scrapes with a sense of unbelief, but I was not enraged. I was terrified. I felt indignation towards my violators, but deeper, a sense of shame and self-loathing. I wanted to be a good woman. I wanted to be a valiant woman. I wanted to be a strong woman. But I felt nothing of the kind. I bought and wore a necklace I loved. It was the symbol for woman with a fist in the middle. I wore the necklace as a proud feminist to show my independence and strength, and I hid in my hotel room. I was terrified of men and terrified of my beauty. Beauty was dangerous. I believed it had attracted the assaults. It had caused me unspeakable pain, and with it, as too many women know, unrelenting shame. When I returned to school, I told my boyfriend what had happened to me. His response was, "You probably deserved it." We had, as you can tell, an abusive relationship. He was verbally abusive and angry. I received no compassion from him, no words of comfort. He wasn't even angry at my assailants. The messages from my childhood wounds were painfully reinforced. Hide your heart. You are a disappointment. You are worthless. No one cares. No one wants to care. You are alone.
If you'll listen carefully to any woman's story, you will hear a theme, the assault on her heart. It might be obvious, as in the stories of physical, verbal, or sexual abuse, or it might be more subtle, the indifference of a world that cares nothing for her but uses her until she is drained. 40 years of being neglected damages a woman's heart, too, dear friends. Either way, the wounds continue to come long after a woman has grown up, but they all seem to speak the same message. Her question is answered again and again throughout her life, the message driven home into her heart like a stake. Melissa was the young girl we told you about whose mother beat her with a 2x4. She eventually got out of the house at the age of 19.
I married a man who was going to be a youth pastor. I thought I had to marry this man since I was so repulsive and would never get another chance. No one else would want me. I was a virgin when I married and loved giving myself to my husband as the ultimate gift. The morning after we were married, I snuggled close to my husband and began to kiss him. He pushed me away and told me he wasn't in the mood. After our wedding night, we didn't have sex again for over a week. He didn't touch me or even seem the least bit interested in me. I was devastated, and again my question was answered the exact same way. As women, we tend to feel that it must be me. That's the effect of our early wounds. Something is fundamentally wrong with me. So many women feel that way. Why are we working so hard to improve ourselves? Or why do we keep so busy that the issues of our hearts never have to come to the surface? We also feel that we are essentially alone, and that somehow the two are related. We believe we are alone because we are not the women we should be. We don't feel worthy of pursuit, so we hang a do not disturb sign on our personalities, send a back off message to the world. Or we desperately seek pursuit, losing all self-respect in an emotional and physical promiscuity. We don't feel that we are irreplaceable, so we try and make ourselves useful. We don't believe we are beautiful, so we work hard to be outwardly beautiful, or we let ourselves go and hide behind a persona that has no allure. We try so hard and in so many ways to protect our hearts from further pain.
What is really going on here? Listen to this report from Amnesty International, recorded of a Sudanese woman who was attacked in the night.
I was sleeping when the attack on Disa started. I was taken away by the attackers. They were all in uniforms. They took dozens of other girls and made us walk for 3 hours. During the day, we were beaten, and they were telling us, "You, the black women, we will exterminate you. You have no God." At night, we were raped several times. The Arabs guarded us with arms, and we were not given food for 3 days.
The story of the treatment of women down through the ages is not a noble history. Oh, it has noble moments to it, to be sure, but taken as a whole, women have endured what seems to be a special hatred ever since we left Eden. The story we just cited is but one of thousands coming not just out of the Sudan, but from many war-torn countries like it. Sexual assault is a far too common theme in these, quote, civil wars. Now, we don't have a political axe to grind, and Stacey's days as a militant feminist are long past. All that aside, what do you make of the degradation, the abuse, and the open assault that women around the world have endured, are enduring even now? Up until about 70 years ago, little girls born in China who were not left by the side of the road to die, because boys are the preferred child, often had their feet bound to keep them small. Small feet were a sign of feminine beauty and were prized by would-be husbands. They were also crippling, which is quite possibly another reason why men thought them a good thing. Women who had their feet bound as children hobbled in pain throughout their lives, unable to walk freely or quickly. Although the practice was outlawed in the 1930s, it continued long after. You might know that through the thousands of years of Jewish history recorded in the Old Testament, Jewish women were considered property with no legal rights, as they were and are in many cultures. They were not allowed to study the law, nor to formally educate their own children. They had a segregated place in the synagogue. It was common practice for a Jewish man to add to his morning prayers, "Thank you, God, for not making me a Gentile. a woman or a slave. A Chinese proverb says that a woman should be like water. She should take no form and have no voice. An Indian proverb says, educating a woman is like watering your neighbor's garden. Meaning, of course, that educating a woman is both foolish and a waste of time. In Hinduism, a woman has less value than a cow. In Islam, a woman requires 3 men to verify her story in court in order for her testimony to be valid. Her testimony, her worth, is 1/3 of a man's. The story goes well beyond the denial of education and legal rights. Clitoridectomy is the removal or circumcision of the clitoris, a painful, horrible practice. Female genital mutilation continues today and is performed on girls when they reach about 5 years old. Done primarily in Africa, the surgery is often performed in the wilderness with the use of a sharp rock. Infections are common. Sometimes the girl dies. A woman is forever maimed, never able to enjoy sexual pleasure, and that is the point. A sexually aware woman is thought to be dangerous. Femininity must be controlled.
Sexual violence against women is rampant throughout the world. It is also rampant against little girls. More than 1 million girls are sold into the sex trade each year. Dear God, what is to account for the systematic, often brutal, nearly universal assault on femininity? Where does this come from? Do not make the mistake of believing that, quote, men are the enemy. Certainly men have had a hand in this and will have a day of reckoning before their maker. But you will not understand this story, or your story, until you begin to see the actual forces behind this and get a grip on their motives. Where does this hatred for women you see all over the world come from? Why is it so diabolical?
A special hatred. For we are not fighting against people made of flesh and blood, but against the evil rulers and authorities of the unseen world, against those mighty powers of darkness who rule this world, and against wicked spirits in the heavenly realms. Ephesians 6, verse 12. The assault on femininity, its long history, its utter viciousness, cannot be understood apart from the spiritual forces of evil we are warned against in the Scriptures. This is not to say that men, and women, for they too assault women, have no accountability in their treatment of women, not at all. It is simply to say that no explanation of the assault upon Eve and all her daughters is sufficient unless it opens our eyes to the Prince of Darkness and his special hatred of femininity. Turn your attention again to the events that took place in the Garden of Eden. Notice, who does the evil one go after? Who does Satan single out for his move against the human race? He could have chosen Adam, but he didn't. Satan went after Eve. He set his sights on her. Have you ever wondered why? It might have been that he, like any predator, chose what he believed to be the weaker of the two. There is some truth to that. He is utterly ruthless. But we believe there is more. Why does Satan make Eve the focus of his assault on humanity? You may know that Satan was first named Lucifer, or Son of the Morning. It infers a glory, a brightness or radiance unique to him. In the days of his former glory, he was appointed a guardian angel. Many believe he was the captain of the angel armies of God, the guardian of the glory of the Lord. In Ezekiel chapter 28, we read, "You were the model of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone adorned you, ruby, topaz, and emerald, chrysolite, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and beryl. Your settings and mountings were made of gold. On the day you were created, they were prepared. You were anointed as a guardian cherub, for so I ordained you. You were on the holy mount of God. You walked among the fiery stones."
Perfect in beauty. That is the key. Lucifer was gorgeous. He was breathtaking, and it was his ruin. Pride entered Lucifer's heart. The angel came to believe he was being cheated somehow. He craved the worship that was being given to God for himself. He didn't merely want to play a noble role in the story. He wanted the story to be about him. He wanted to be the star. He wanted the attention, the adoration for himself. Mirror, mirror, on the wall.
Your heart became proud on account of your beauty, and you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. Ezekiel 28:17.
Satan fell because of his beauty. Now his heart for revenge is to assault beauty. He destroys it in the natural world wherever he can. Strip mines, oil spills, fires, Chernobyl. He wreaks destruction on the glory of God in the earth like a psychopath committed to destroying great works of art. But most especially, he hates Eve. Because she is captivating, uniquely glorious, and he cannot be. She is the incarnation of the beauty of God. More than anything else in all creation, she embodies the glory of God. She allures the world to God. He hates it with a jealousy we can only imagine. And there is more. The evil one also hates Eve because she gives life. Women give birth, not men. Women nourish life. And they also bring life into the world soulfully, relationally, spiritually, in everything they touch. Satan was a murderer from the beginning. John 8:44. He brings death. His is a kingdom of death. Ritual, sacrifices, genocide, the Holocaust, abortion, those are his ideas. And thus, Eve is his greatest human threat, for she brings life. She is a lifesaver and a life giver. Eve means life, or life producer. Adam named his wife Eve because she would become the mother of all the living. Genesis 3:20.
You put those two things together, that Eve incarnates the beauty of God, and she gives life to the world. His bitter heart cannot bear it. He assaults her with a special hatred. History removes any doubt about this. Do you begin to see it? Think of the great stories. In nearly all of them, the villain goes after the hero's true love. He turns his sights on the beauty. Magua goes after Korra in The Last of the Mohicans. Longshanks goes after Muron in Braveheart. Commodus goes after Maximus's wife in Gladiator. The witch attacks Sleeping Beauty. The stepsisters assault Cinderella. Satan goes after Eve. This explains an awful lot. It is not meant to scare you. Actually, it will shed so much light on your life's story if you'll let it. Most of you thought that the things that have happened to you were somehow your fault, that you deserved it. If only you had been prettier or smarter or done more or pleased them, somehow it wouldn't have happened. You would have been loved. They wouldn't have hurt you.
And most of you are living with the guilt that somehow it's your fault you aren't more deeply pursued now, that you do not have an essential role in a great adventure, that you have no beauty to unveil. The message of our wounds nearly always is, this is because of you. This is what you deserve. It changes things to realize that, no, it is because you are glorious that these things happened. It is because you are a major threat to the kingdom of darkness. Because you uniquely carry the glory of God to the world. You are hated because of your beauty and power.
On a human level. Okay, I have a confession to make. I didn't want to co-author this book. Oh, I thought it ought to be written. It needed to be written. I just didn't want to be the one to do it. I knew it would require me to enter into the world of women and into my woman's world in a far deeper way than daily life requires of me. To do any sort of justice to a book for women would require me to go deep, listen even more carefully, study, delve into the mystery. Okay, the bloody mess of a woman's soul. Part of me just didn't want to go there. I had what felt like an allergic reaction. Pull back, withdraw. I was keenly aware of this going on inside of me, and I felt like a jerk. But I also knew enough about myself and about the battle for a woman's heart that I needed to explore this ambivalence. What is this thing in me, and in most men, that just doesn't want to go deep into a woman's world? You are too much, too hard. It's too much work. Men are simpler, easier. And isn't that just the message you've lived with all your life as a woman? You're too much and not enough. You're just not worth the effort. And why is it such an effort? There must be something wrong with you. Now, part of a man's fundamental reluctance to truly dive into the world of a woman comes from a man's deepest fear, failure. Oh, he may joke about the differences of men and women, Mars and Venus and all that, but the truth is, he is scared. He fears that having delved into his woman's world, he won't have what it takes to help her there. That is his sin. That is his cowardice. And because of her shame, most of the time, a man gets away with it. Most marriages and long-term dating relationships reach this sort of unspoken settlement. The guy says, "I'm not coming any closer. This is as far as I'm willing to go, but I won't leave, and that ought to make you happy." And so there is this sort of détente, a cordial agreement to live only so close.
The effect is that most women feel alone.
Now, some of this is simply selfishness on the part of men. Lord knows, men are selfish and self-centered. When Eve was first assaulted, Adam didn't do jack squat. Men sin through violence and through passivity. It's that plain and simple and ugly. But there is something else. There is something even more diabolical at work here. We had an amazing meeting a few months ago that proved to be, for me at least, a surprise unveiling of this mystery. Stacy and I had gathered with the men and women in our ministry who do the men's and women's retreats. The men's team wanted to offer our counsel and support and prayer to the women's team for their upcoming event. It was a chance for the women, and each of them are really, really amazing women, to just sort of open their hearts to us and process how things were going. Our gathering moved rather quickly from external kinds of issues, how long should the sessions be, and logistical stuff like that, to the internal world of the women's team themselves. As we began to talk more intimately, something started coming over me. Just a sense, an inexplicable but strong impression. Back off. That's what I felt. No one said it. Nothing they were doing implied it. It wasn't a voice in my head. Just a very strong impression. I wasn't sure where it was coming from, but this strong reluctance, this sense of maybe we shouldn't press further into this, this feeling of just back off was growing in me or over me every moment we move more deeply into their lives. With every step we took toward their hearts, I felt a stronger impression to end the conversation, withdraw, bail out. Watching this unfold, I knew I was onto something big. I knew that, as a man, this wasn't my heart's true desire toward these women. I love them. I want to fight for them. I have, many times. I knew as well it could not be their heart's desire. They invite our engagement. So I interrupted the flow of the conversation with what seemed like an unrelated question to the women. "Do you feel alone in this?" Silence. Then tears, deep tears, from some deep place within each of them. "Yes," they all said, "we do." But I knew it was more than about the retreats. "Do you feel like that in your lives, too? I mean, generally, as a woman?" "Yes, absolutely. I feel alone most of the time." Now, you have to understand that each of these women have deep and meaningful relationships in their lives. I knew that if they feel alone, my God, what must every other woman feel as well? And this strong message of back off, if we men feel that after years of fighting for them, whoa, What must all the other guys out there feel? I bet they haven't ever identified it or put words to it, but I'll guarantee they felt it and probably just thought it was what they or their woman or both of them wanted. Back off, or leave her alone, or you don't really want to go there. She'll be too much for you. Is something Satan has set against every woman from the day of her birth. It's the emotional and spiritual equivalent of leaving a little girl by the side of the road to die. And to every woman he has whispered, you are alone. Or, when they see who you really are, you will be alone. Or no one will ever really come for you.
Take a moment. Quiet your heart and ask yourself, is this a message I have believed, feared, lived with? Not only do most fear they will ultimately be abandoned by the men in their lives, they fear it from other women as well, that they will be abandoned by their friends and left alone. It is time to reveal this pervasive threat, this crippling fear, this terrible lie. We're reminded of a scene from The Two Towers, the second film in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. It takes place in the land of Rohan, in the hall of the king, in the chambers of the lovely Eowyn. She is the king's niece, the only lady of the court. Her dearest cousin Theodred, the son of the king, has just died from wounds he received in battle. She is grieving her loss when Wormtongue, supposed counselor to the king but a treacherous, vile creature, slinks into her chambers and begins to weave his spell around the unprotected maiden.
Oh, he must have died sometime during the night. What a tragedy for the king to lose his only son and heir. I understand. His passing is hard to accept, especially now that your brother has deserted you.
Leave me alone, snake!
Oh, but you are alone. Who knows what you have spoken to the darkness in bitter watches of the night, when all your life seems to shrink, the walls of your bower closing in about you, a hushed, tremblesome, wild thing. So fair and so cold, like a morning with pale spring still clinging to winter's chill.
Your words are poison.
Oh, but you are alone. This is the way of the evil one towards you, dear heart. He plays upon a woman's worst fear, abandonment. He arranges for her to be abandoned, and he puts his spin on every event he can to make it seem like abandonment.
There is hope.
I am not letting men off the hook. God knows, we have a lot more repenting to do. I am saying that you won't begin to understand the long and sustained assault on femininity, on women, on you, until you see it as part of something larger, the most wicked force the world has ever known. The enemy bears a special hatred for Eve. If you believe he has any role in the history of this world, you can't help but see it. The evil one had a hand in all that has happened to you. If he didn't arrange for the assault directly, and certainly human sin has a large enough role to play, then he made sure he drove the message of the wounds home to your heart. He is the one who has dogged your heels with shame and self-doubt and accusation. He is the one who offers the false comforters to you in order to deepen your bondage. He is the one who has done these things in order to prevent your restoration. For that is what he fears. He fears who you are, what you are, what you might become. He fears your beauty and your life-giving heart. Now, listen to the voice of your king. This is God's heart toward you. For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent. For Jerusalem's sake, I will not remain quiet till her righteousness shines out like the dawn, her salvation like a blazing torch. The nations will see your righteousness and all kings your glory, your beauty.
you will be called by a new name that the mouth of the Lord will bestow. You will be a crown of splendor in the Lord's hand, a royal diadem in the hand of your God. No longer will they call you deserted or name your land desolate, but you will be called, my delight is in her, and your land married. For the Lord will take delight in you, and your land will be married, as a young man marries a maiden, as a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will your God rejoice over you. From Isaiah chapter 62. And listen to this from Jeremiah chapter 30. But all who devour you will be devoured. All your enemies will go into exile. Those who plunder you will be plundered. All who make spoil of you, I will despoil. But I will restore you to health and heal your wounds, declares the Lord, because you are called an outcast, Zion, for whom no one cares. You won't really understand your life as a woman until you understand this. You are passionately loved by the God of the universe, and you are passionately hated by his enemy.
And so, dear heart, it is time for your restoration. For there is one greater than your enemy, one who has sought you out from the beginning of time. He has come to heal your broken heart and restore your feminine soul. Let us now turn to him.
To continue, please insert the next CD.